Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
The microphone's working. Thanks for coming along, folks. We've had a busy time this week and again next week. But I became aware of Fiona Allen's book, Renovating Nation, Our Obsessions with Home, and thought it would make a good topic for us here. So that's why Fiona Allen has come along tonight, and she's a writer and critic who specialises in the analysis of contemporary Australian culture and politics. Dr. Allen's a commentator on current affairs, on social issues and popular culture, and researches and writes on a broad range of subjects. And she's taught at universities in Australia, Britain and Germany. But currently, Fiona Allen is lecturer in gender and cultural studies at the University of Sydney, and she's going to talk to us tonight on renovation nation. Hi. Welcome, Fiona. Thank you.
Okay, so thanks, Jared. So, I'd like to begin by thanking Jared and Anne Henderson for the invitation to speak at the Sydney Institute tonight and for organising the event. And I'd like to also thank you all for coming along. It's a great pleasure to be here. Now, my book, Renovation Nation, Our Obsession with Home, came out late last year. So what I'd like to do tonight is not just talk about the ideas of the book, but to try to connect some of them to some recent events. And I think you may have a good idea what those recent events are. Now, Renovation Nation deals quite extensively with themes of real estate speculation, home ownership and mortgages, including the subprime mortgage market. So its appearance in the middle of what was initially called the subprime crisis was exceptionally good timing. The subprime crisis, do we even remember now that that's how the global financial crisis actually started? Mind you, the satisfaction of timeliness soon turned into anxiety about the book being washed away by the financial tsunami that began to dominate every inch of newspaper coverage and every moment of public debate. A tsunami that included a flood of revised and reissued popular books about economics. After all, a crisis is also a great publishing opportunity. All you really need is a good introduction, a new introduction. However, I'd also like to think that there was some degree of prescience involved in the timing of my book. After all, for some years now, homeowners have been asking more and more of their homes. They've been asking them to be tickets to quick and easy riches, assets, investments and stores of equity, sources of income, de facto ATM machines, basically, for supplying cheap lines of credit for consumption, and especially for the most popular pastime of home equity withdrawal, home renovations. Homeowners have also been banking on their homes in other ways too, seeing their housing wealth as a substitute for pensions, superannuation and retirement schemes and forms of social welfare in general. As last month's Economist put it, consumers have become obsessed with the idea of the house as their main store of wealth, regarding it as a combination of a cash cow and a pension plan. In effect, housing wealth has increasingly become seen as the key to and the guarantee for all other kinds of wealth, prosperity and financial security more generally. So what we've been doing, in other words, is betting the whole house precisely on that, our house. The worldwide rise in house prices over the past decade and a half has been called the biggest housing bubble in history. Homeowners marvelled as the value of their homes spiralled upwards. This so-called new era of prosperity, represented by the increased availability of credit, low interest rates, low inflation and rising asset values, brought wealth and affluence to large numbers of ordinary suburban families and households. Both the economy and the property market seemed as if they would continue to boom indefinitely. And some even declared the usual inevitable bust would not be repeated and was merely a historical curiosity, a flaw of the past. Now, the mortgage and housing markets were central to these wealth effects produced by increased prosperity, or at least the perception of increasing prosperity. And one of the major consequences of this large upswing in the residential real estate market was the general expectation that ordinary households should be able to derive significant income from profitable investment or speculation. The meanings of home ownership also fundamentally changed during the period of the boom. A house was no longer primarily a means of shelter or a roof over one's head. Rather, it became a vehicle for investment, capital gains, and further wealth accumulation. One of the results of this redefinition was that home price speculation became more entrenched on national and international scales than ever before. Now, in the conclusion to my book, Renovation Nation, I wrote that the US housing crisis, triggered by widespread defaulting in the subprime mortgage market, has become a global event in all kinds of ways. Its repercussions have already been felt, and no one knows the scale of the damage yet to come to international financial markets. Well, we're still not entirely sure, but we have a fair enough idea. It's been claimed that an estimated 10 to 12 million US households will not be able to pay their mortgages over the next 4 years. And one article I read recently by globalisation scholar Saskia Sassen claimed that there are an average of 10,000 mortgage foreclosures every day. There are also around 10 million households with negative home equity. That is, the amount that is owed on their home, on the mortgage, is more than the value of the house itself. In Australia, meanwhile, housing stress is now a major concern for all kinds of households. This includes low-income renters, unable to find affordable housing, as well as families in mortgage stress, struggling to make loan repayments. Some Australian homeowners are also finding it very hard to sell their houses because they're now worth so much less than when they first bought. They're very much stuck between a brick and a hard place. The Western Sydney seat of Blaxland, as we know, is Paul Keating's former seat, is now referred to as the mortgage stress capital of Australia. Last year, before interest rates started to fall, the current federal member for Blaxland, Jason Clare, reported that there were approximately 3 house repossessions each day in the area and that levels of financial stress were severe. Now, in 2008, US Treasury Secretary Henry Hank Paulson called a bursting housing bubble the most significant risk to our economy. And later that year, the global markets did something that Alan Greenspan subsequently called a once-in-a-half-century, probably once-in-a-century event. They froze. So the subprime crisis morphed into a liquidity crisis, then a credit crunch, and then quickly became a global financial crisis. And now, as we all know, we're facing what has been called a global recession, the Great Recession, as it's been known. In the fallout from the global town downturn, there has been much hand-wringing and soul-searching to find out and understand the causes of the crisis. And in this unfolding global drama, there is certainly no shortage of villains to name, blame and shame. Greedy investment bankers, and even the sin of greed itself. Traders and their financial weapons of mass destruction. Unscrupulous predatory mortgage brokers. Overpaid captains of industry. And even the captain of the American financial system and Federal Reserve himself, Alan Greenspan. They've all been singled out for criticism and have even been named as the culprits who caused the crisis. In fact, a few weeks ago here at the Sydney Institute, the Sydney Morning Herald journalist, Peter Harcher, gave an address in which he levelled the blame for the crisis fairly and squarely at Greenspan and the loose monetary policy that he presided over during his watch. There is certainly a great deal of comfort and reassurance to be gained from isolating a single individual or entity as the cause or culprit of the crisis. In a way, it's similar to believing that our fate is always in the hands of the gods. The complexity of life suddenly becomes a lot simpler, and responsibility has a single source and is easily explained. Now, as Harcher outlined in his talk, we should more or less discount the global savings glut, China's new role as an exporter of capital to the world, the popularity of new financial products such as derivatives, financial deregulation, house price inflation, and so on, and realise that one man, and one man only, was really responsible for the current crisis, Alan Greenspan. Now, while Harcher at least mentions these wider processes as possible contributing factors, chief among his targets is Greenspan himself. Now, I'm a university lecturer in gender studies, and as I tell my students every week, putting the blame fairly and squarely on one man's shoulders may be easy, it may be reassuring, and it may even be partly true, but it's rarely ever that simple. After listening to Peter Harcher on that evening a few weeks ago, and please don't get me wrong, I think Harcher is a fine and insightful journalist, you know, one of our best. I asked myself, what does this analysis, this explanation, offer us more broadly as we assess the damage caused by the downturn? Not just to our financial system, but to our society more broadly. How does blaming Alan Greenspan help us look beyond the more obvious economic issues that are at stake here, so that we can also view the social, political and cultural forces that came into play, forces which also undoubtedly contributed to the mess we're in? So, in contrast to Harcher's explanation and the simplicity of it, the kind of analysis that I'm interested in here leads me into the complex and difficult terrain of social attitudes, values, behaviours, expectations, everyday practices, all of those things that we usually call a culture. In contrasting to focusing on a single individual like Greenspan, or a single figure like a predatory mortgage broker, or a single entity such as extreme capitalism, focusing on a culture means looking at something that is quite diffuse, dispersed, multiple and complex, and involves everyone. Central banks, economists, institutions, the media, politicians, and ordinary individuals like all of us. A culture also includes what John Maynard Keynes called animal spirits, those spontaneous urges and feelings, spontaneous action rather than inaction, those psychological and emotional states of behaviour that create feelings of trust, confidence, optimism, pessimism and bad faith. And we have to just look at the current credit crisis to see these spirits very literally and very concretely crippling the financial system. It also includes new era stories that suggest that the good times of the new era will continue forever. And the great myths of real estate, there's nothing as safe as houses, that bricks and mortar are the best bet, that house prices never fall. Because it's so intangible, so widespread, and in a sense so natural, a culture is actually very difficult to talk about and to analyse. But I think that is actually what we have to do to gain a deeper, more comprehensive understanding of what caused the boom, the bust, and the predicament we're now in. It is also what we have to do in order to take up Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens' challenge to redefine prosperity so that it's not just seen as something achieved by ever-escalating mineral prices or simply by bidding up the prices of our houses. In 1992, James Carville, Bill Clinton's campaign advisor during the election campaign that saw Clinton defeat the first George Bush, coined the phrase, "It's the economy, stupid." And in a globalised and interconnected world, economies, nations and households are as open and vulnerable to worldwide economic fluctuations as never before. But what I'd like to suggest here is that alongside the primacy and prominence of the economy in our lives now, it's important to recognise that it's also the culture, stupid. This is certainly not to suggest that understanding what's happening at the level of economics isn't important. It's just that economics and the economy don't take place in a vacuum. As Joseph Stiglitz recently said, there's a reason the invisible hand of the market is invisible. It doesn't exist. Economic behaviour needs, therefore, I believe, to be understood within the overall context of the social and cultural order in which all human practice is immersed and embedded. But let me be clear, I'm not letting Alan Greenspan and monetary policy off the hook here. There is undoubtedly a real need to question our reliance on it as the main lever of control for establishing some ideal economic equilibrium. And now is an opportune moment to reflect upon the ascendancy of, and indeed the obsession with, monetarism. Over the last few decades, it became an article of faith that we could, indeed we should, rely on central banks to control economies through finely tuned monetary policy. During this time, governments and central banks single-mindedly battle to make sure that the genie of inflation stayed securely in its bottle. They also single-mindedly applied themselves to reducing government debt at whatever cost, while allowing levels of personal debt to reach unprecedented and unsustainable levels. Now, I don't want to sound like Steve Keen here, but I think we do need to acknowledge that levels of household debt in Australia reach levels even higher than in the United States. Yet despite the prominence of monetarism over the last decades, I really don't believe it's very credible or particularly insightful to blame all the excesses of the recent years on loose monetary policy. While cheap credit may certainly have had the effect of boosting the global asset price boom, it was not in itself an exogenous factor that caused the bubble and its inevitable bust. In a rush to find explanations for the crisis, there has been a tendency, I think, to confuse and conflate factors that were themselves products of the bubble and to see them simply as causes. In fact, both in the United States and in Australia, there was a dogged determination to keep buying houses irrespective of what interest rates were doing. And as Robert Shiller has explained in relation to the United States context, the interest rate cuts cannot explain the general 9-year upward trend that we have seen in the housing market. The housing boom period was 3 times as long as the period of low interest rates. And in fact, the housing boom was like it was here, accelerating when the Fed was increasing rates in the 1990s. So the conclusion that I think we can draw from this is that monetary policy appears to have been driven, at least in part, by the same lack of understanding that produced the bubble itself. In other words, the Fed and central banks around the world and the mortgage lenders and the investors in the mortgages that were bundled together as residential mortgage-backed securities and collateralised debt obligations all saw home prices as increasing and continuing. And these individuals and institutions were, in a sense, no different to the borrowers, both prime and subprime, who were obsessed by the idea of somehow gaining a foothold in a rising housing market. So my argument here is really that by not taking into account the wider culture in which excessive borrowing and excessive debt is situated, the behavioural explanations of why people want houses, even central banks reach their limits of usefulness, being able to address the situation only by using a very blunt, clumsy instrument, interest rates. Now, our preoccupation with real estate, with home ownership, and with consuming more and more housing ultimately, therefore, transcends rational explanations associated with economics and economic theory. What this means is the motivations for our behaviour, especially the amount of debt we are prepared to take on to get a foot in the door of the housing market, are not explainable simply by economic and financial variables. Our obsession with home, with housing, and the effects it creates, like overinvestment in property, uninformed and just plain stupid speculation, debt-ridden home buyers amid escalating levels of risk, vulnerable mortgagors, housing stress and widespread housing unaffordability, sits within a much broader landscape driven by social attitudes and values, politics, perceptions of unbounded economic prosperity, and national histories and traditions. In other words, it's about culture. It's the culture, stupid. Now, of course, it's not possible to discount the roles played by cheap credit and the guiding principle of the real estate market, location, location, location. But the culture is actually the glue that binds these things together. It's the culture that produces the property investment seminar, the real estate-dominated dinner party conversation, the housing affordability barbecue stopper. It's the culture that makes society as a collective forego rationality and economic prudence and common sense, and in the moment of classic irrational exuberance, bid up house prices to a level its children will never afford. Now, this is the specific culture, the patterns and ways of thinking and feeling, behaving, that's driving the boom in housing. And in a sense, that's exactly what happened here. When the housing boom really took off, Australia's long-standing obsession with home ownership was unleashed on a scale never previously seen. Many people were prepared to do anything to get a toehold on the property ladder. This included taking on truckloads of debt and dodgy low-doc or even no-doc loans. Perhaps it's no surprise that supply couldn't keep up with demand. So a culture of borrowing became the norm. The household debt-to-income ratio confirmed this, rising from 56% in the 90s to more than 160% in 2007. In other words, the typical household at this time spent far more than it actually earned. The Reserve Bank said that there was no domestic precedent for this state of affairs, and as the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank, Rick Battaglino, reported, it was housing-related debt in particular that had increased so significantly. And actually, our obsession with consuming more and more housing, which had been most responsible for the debt that was held by the household sector. So, just to give you some figures here, in the 10 years between 1997 and 2007, households borrowed $770 billion. Of this, Most of it, 90%, went on buying houses. To be even more precise, $420 billion was used to buy houses to live in, and $240 billion was used to buy investment properties. So the exuberance that Australians showed in buying houses and investment properties, and I think it's worth pointing out that in 2003, loans for investment housing actually became the fastest growing category of household borrowing. This exuberance was also matched by exuberance for homeowners to dip into their household equity. In the decade up to 2007, there was an astonishing amount of households steadily withdrawing their equity, whereas in previous years, they'd steadily built it up. Indeed, during this decade, the growth in housing credit exceeded the value of new housing being built. In other words, we took more out of our equity than we actually injected into it, something that had never happened before. And for many people, it was becoming worryingly obvious that housing equity is increasingly viewed as a solution to all future financial needs. So where did all this withdrawn equity go, you may be asking? Well, house prices were not the only things that had grown to spectacular proportions. So had the houses themselves. During the boom, the Australian dream got completely rescaled. It actually looked like it was on steroids. Even though household sizes have been getting smaller, the four-bedroom house became the most desired kind of dwelling. The floor space of new houses also increased by around 40% over 25 years. And if we weren't personally involved in some real estate transaction or major home improvement undertaking, we were certainly bound to be watching one on television. Now, as Paul Krugman has outlined in his most recent work, Depression Economics, this climate of excessive optimism about a new era of unprecedented global prosperity stemmed in part from a sense by the late 1990s that the central problem of the business cycle, of boom followed by bust, if it had not been entirely eliminated, it had at least been decisively tamed, perhaps even had even been solved. So when one believes that the future looks just like the present and that prosperity will go on forever, the arrogant assumption is also that the unpredictability of economic life has been conquered, overcome and left behind. And not so long ago, there was no shortage of experts telling us that actually this was the case. And why would we want to doubt the economic models that showed that the good times would continue to roll forever? And examples from both the American and the Australian context clearly illustrate that the very people who should have been responsible for oversight, for caution, and for recommending greater regulation and greater restraint were as convinced as the general public by the prospect of limitless growth and prosperity and had exactly the same expectations of future home price increases. And I think one of the reasons the global financial crisis that we're currently in seems so spectacular is simply because very few people saw it coming. Now, most of our authorities actually never even use the term housing bubble. In fact, most of our authorities, the ones now calling for heroic New Deal-style measures, for a new Bretton Woods, who denounce fear and greed at every turn, not only denied that there was a problem with house prices rising so dramatically, but they actually did all they could to keep the boom thundering along. For example, Alan Greenspan, in his 2007 book, The Age of Turbulence, recalled the housing boom in these terms. He said, "I would tell audiences that we were facing not a bubble, but a froth. Lots of small local bubbles that never grew to a scale that could threaten the health of the overall economy. George W. Bush introduced a series of measures, including his home ownership challenge, to make home ownership accessible to increasing numbers of Americans, especially minority groups. And he used the same language of patriotism and persuasion as his counterparts here. Owning a home lies at the heart of the American dream, Bush declared again and again and again. Now, when he was Prime Minister, John Howard also repeatedly emphasised his commitment to both home ownership and to high house prices. Howard said he was committed to Australia remaining a great home-owning society, indeed one of the greatest in the world, where the dream of home ownership remains at the heart of the Australian experience and within reach of each successive generation. For Howard, the housing boom that was driving up house prices and actually making home ownership more unaffordable for successive generations was not a problem. As he explained in Parliamentary Question Time in 2007, a true housing crisis in this country is when there is a sustained fall in the value of our homes and in house prices. And as he said to a radio caller in Brisbane in 2003, I haven't had anybody shake their fist at me and say, Howard, I'm angry with you for letting the value of my house increase. Kevin Rudd has demonstrated a remarkably similar attitude to maintaining house price inflation, despite it being generally understood that giving people more money to spend on housing only leads to more expensive housing. The Rudd government boosted the first homeowners grant threefold. Rudd himself has been urging people to take on home ownership, even if that means that first home buyers are entering into an inflated, distorted, false economy created by the grant itself. In today's uncertain and precarious climate of rising unemployment and falling house values, urging people to take on large mortgages is perhaps not the most responsible advice the government should be providing. As one newspaper headline put it, it's becoming the first homeowner's time bomb. Essentially, Ms. Grant, I believe, will simply increase demand, put more upward pressure on prices, and therefore do little to improve long-term affordability, and perhaps will make it even worse. The Rudd government policies, therefore, seem to be more concerned with supporting and perpetuating real estate myths and preventing a collapse in house prices at whatever cost. Yet the Reserve Bank, and as you probably noticed from my quotations throughout my paper, I'm a big fan, has said time and again, one can make the case that the population in aggregate, the community, does not benefit from increases in house prices. What's both surprising and disturbing then is that despite the prosperity, the credit revolution, and the so-called democratisation of finance, the home ownership rate has actually not increased, and some are even claiming it may have dropped over the last decade. The benefits of low interest rates have therefore been largely nullified by house price inflation and have been simply capitalised into soaring house prices rather than leading to a wider and fairer spread of owner occupation. And in fact, as the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank said, once again, Rick Battaglino, in Australia, the boom was concentrated on existing homeowners who traded up to bigger and better houses and bought investment properties. Now, Alan Greenspan used the term irrational exuberance to describe these kinds of episodes of collective speculative fever or speculative mania. But in a way, these home buyers were simply being exuberantly very, very rational. The logic of financialisation that has permeated our culture over the last few decades has led to a widespread belief that if you weren't investing or speculating in the real estate market, basically, you're a mug. The language of market populism became so pervasive and financialisation became seen as such an unstoppable natural force there really did seem to be very little alternative to jumping on board and becoming an investor in the stakeholder society, the shareholder democracy, the property-owning democracy. As the economist Robert Shiller argues, it is actually this change in thinking about ourselves that is the deepest cause of the bubble, and maybe the slowest to unravel after the bubble comes to an end. So, homeowners all over the world are now more likely to be experiencing the painful correction of the housing bust than the pleasures of rising asset values and big capital gains, the high that some thought would never end. The large number of people who risked all to keep it alive, the dream has now become something of a nightmare. Home, that important place of stability, shelter, and sanctuary, is now also a place of risk, fear, and anxiety, where you're often a prisoner of debt. And rather than offering economic security, it now often symbolises financial hardship and loss. Our cities have housing that is less affordable than ever. Younger people may want to keep the dream alive, but it may well be one of the many goals the future looks set to deny them. So I really think the critical questions need to be asked now. Are our current models of growth and prosperity really sustainable for borrowers, for lenders, for the Australian economy, for future generations, our children, and especially for the environment? The power and growth of the Australian economy between 1990 and 2005 was so strong that it has been labelled the longest decade of prosperity in Australian history. And real wealth increased more in this short space of 15 years than it had in the previous 30 years. But where is the legacy of this age of abundance? Where are the signs of this embarrassment of riches? If it didn't take material shape in the form of large-scale infrastructure projects and better services, then perhaps it had a less ostentatious form in, say, a keener sense of responsibility to others. Ballooning government revenues rarely ended up funding forms of public investment or additional funding for research and development or education and training, but went largely into personal tax breaks. The wealth that ordinary Australians secured led not to an enlarged spirit of generosity, but to an expanding sense of entitlement. Expectations of limitless growth, limitless prosperity, and steadily rising standards of living became entrenched and taken for granted. But I believe that we're now slowly beginning to recognise the limits of a prosperity defined solely in terms of personal affluence and individual entitlement, of bigger, endlessly renovated houses and bigger real estate portfolios. And as we realise that the limits to growth are not only economic, but also ethical and ecological and environmental, we're also beginning to reassess our reliance on models of ever-expanding growth. And hopefully this realisation will also incorporate a redefinition of Australia and Australian prosperity as something more than simply the quarry with a view, as George Megalogene has termed it. I also believe that we're slowly realising that no nation can sustain itself by buying and selling real estate. Households are often told that the essential wisdom of good financial literacy and the key principle of economic security too is diversification. Households are therefore recommended to have a diversified portfolio of assets and investments. But I think the same piece of wisdom is no less relevant to nations and to national economies and on a number of fronts. It doesn't just apply to the tendency to sink all of our wealth into bricks and mortar, into our homes. Diversification of wealth should also be matched by diversification of housing forms and tenures, not simply the Australian dream of home ownership. And in turn, this diversification could perhaps also lead to alternative definitions of prosperity that are not simply linked to ever-escalating mineral prices and ever more expensive homes. Thank you.
Thank you, Fiona. Well, we've got, the copies of, Janet Grundy's got copies of Renovation Nation, Our Obsession with Home Outside. We've got to about 7 o'clock. I confess I've got to leave right on 7 because we're going to go to an auction. Just kidding.
Just a joke.
So, questions, discussion? Anne?
Yep. In all of this, I always ask myself, how much is it really about Australia? Because when I was young, a long time ago, the British were tended to have public housing and rent and all of that. They've changed dramatically after Margaret Thatcher wanted to make more homeowners. The housing bubble crisis in the States goes back to Jimmy Carter, a social democrat who wanted to let the poor have what the rich had, a home of their own. Mm. And if you look at the TV, pay TV, if you've got it, there's heaps and heaps of these programs. I agree with you about renovations, but they're not just Australian. There's, if you want a home in the country, there's one show from the British. There's, all the British have gone all over Europe buying places in Spain, Serbia, wherever. This whole thing is not national to me. It's just affluence. Have you thought about that?
Well, yeah.
Can you speak down to the end of the room? Yeah.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, no, I certainly agree. It's certainly not limited at all to Australia. I mean, it's global. But I think because it's global, it's an interesting shift in our understanding of politics, of political systems, and ideas about individuals and citizens as well, and I think it's part of a broader shift towards regarding housing wealth as the main form of wealth and security for individuals in general. And I think so. It's just because it's not national doesn't mean it has consequences that I don't. That shouldn't be analysed in national terms.
Okay, so we go right down the back. Yeah, John. Yeah.
Just a couple of comments to your thoughts. First of all, you described it as global. That's not really true. Germany, for instance, has not had a particular housing boom.
Sure.
There have been some increases in prices for everyone.
Yeah.
In the US, the average figures will show enormous distortion in housing prices. Mm. But in many areas, it's not been true. And at least part of that may be due to, one, shortage of land as opposed to demand. California particularly hit as far as because they had to keep up the population. And very tight zoning rules, but it's abusive, which has a significant increase in construction, but as well as relaxed zoning. Germany, because it had a long-standing tradition of long-term leases, people could buy houses if they want permanent. And if you have a short series of short-term leases, you have no permits. The Germans do have that. That's, I think, rather major. And finally, I think it's not such the house that actually is called the cause of increase in value, it's the land.
Yeah.
Really, housing construction is just an add-on to the land price. And a lot of this, I suspect, is due to artificial constraints to the supply of land and infrastructure.
Just a brief response to 3 points.
Yeah, sure. No, I agree with much of what you said. And I think Germany is a really good example. I mean, Germany, I think the reason why Germany doesn't have the kind of house price inflation that we've seen in other countries is because tenants actually have controls around their rental conditions and their tenancies. And I think that renting has become such an established feature of that country that it's actually protected to a great extent in a way that it's not here, for example. And I think that the usual politicians now know by rote the story that, oh, of course, what's happened in the subprime crisis will not happen here because, we don't have an oversupply of housing. And we have a lack of supply. But I still think, the kinds of affordability issues that we face here, demand some really serious attention. I mean, they've become systemic, and I think homeowner grants are are really a band-aid solution to those kind of wider problems of housing affordability. And I think that, you know, the arguments that we hear from demographia and people like that saying, okay, all we need to do is release more land, you know, these typical supply side solutions are actually quite limited. And I think it's, you know, we have to actually look at the shift in attitudes to housing and our expectations of what housing can deliver, and look at the problem of escalating demand and think more creatively about the housing and the way we provide housing in our cities.
Question down the back on the other side.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was going to ask you the question about in society, you know, OECD countries where home ownership rates are down at 40% of mixed income norms, but I think that's touched on that. You mentioned that at the same time as average household sizes in Australia have shrunk, the scale of housing, particularly in the middle and outer end suburbs, has grown enormously. So the mismatch in terms of what's really needed. The question I've got is about some of the affordability issues. We, particularly in this state, but generally in Australia, have not gone where the US or the UK or elsewhere have got eligible levies, etc., those types of things. I guess the question I've got is, if we're ever going to make a difference, get social mixability into housing, postal jobs and transport, we've got to do some of that. Do you think in the current environment, coming out of the current recession, we have an opportunity?
Well, I'd certainly like to think so. And I heard Tanya Plibersek talk here at the Sydney Institute a few weeks ago, and the plans that she was basically speaking about in terms of public housing and community housing were, I think, very good initiatives. And I think that diversification of housing and, as you say, the social mix of housing are really key in this issue. But at the moment, I mean, I think it's quite disappointing that we actually don't have a vision for our cities and a vision for affordability. We don't realise what a systemic problem it has become, and we're basically just trying to fix the fringes, kind of very literally building more houses on the fringes and thinking the fringes we will be able to, you know, accommodate this, you know, excessive demand. And I think that's a very short-sighted response. And I suppose, just getting back to Anne's question at the beginning, I think, yeah, sure, this phenomenon is global, but, and of course, all around the world, you know, housing wealth is now replacing forms of welfare. But I think, as we've seen in the current downturn, I mean, the risks of actually of individuals who probably don't completely understand the way financial processes work are very great, and that we're asking them to basically carry the burden of these risks when they perhaps are the least able to accommodate them. And I think, you know, there's a project that I'm actually involved in which is looking at mortgage equity withdrawal, house equity withdrawal, not only in Australia but in the United States and in England. And as I said, you know, housing wealth is regarded as the solution to all financial needs in the future. And that's, I think, a very worrying prospect.
It's a question here, yeah.
Yeah, I noticed that you're involved in gender as well as cultural studies. I'd just like to raise perhaps a somewhat provocative question as to whether or not you think that this rise of home, I mean, traditionally women are interested in the home, men are interested in work. I won't go into that debate, but I'd just like to ask you the question whether, in fact, the rise of home renovation and the mansion and so on has got to do with somehow to do with female ambition and the particular orientation of that ambition towards the home.
Yeah, I'm a gender studies scholar, but I actually hadn't thought about renovation in gender terms before. Interesting. But I thought you were actually going to talk about you know, the dual income, which of course has had a major impact on rising house prices, I think, and the fact that, you know, people do have more money to actually spend on housing, and that has actually been capitalised into house prices too, I think. So that's very interesting. I don't know. I mean, look at, say, for example, the TV series like The Block, where you had a gay couple that were renovating as fervently and as enthusiastically as a heterosexual couple. So I don't know. I think the gender aspects of that are maybe more complex than just women.
So they used to say when I was an academic, there's ground there for more research. perhaps even a grant.
I wonder to what extent it's actually our tax and social security legislation that is responsible to some of the home ownership, the obsession with home ownership. I mean, we all know that when it comes to a person becoming eligible to get a pension, the house stands outside the means test, the home. And also, if you, let's say, live in a modest home and you invest in another property or you put your money in the bank or into shares, you get penalized tax-wise, also when it comes to capital gains. So aren't Australians being encouraged to put all their money into their home rather than to use the money in more productive ways? And for instance, if we put more money into industry and such, it would be much better for the economy all over.
But
it's just everything we put in. So that we get the benefit of being exempt from all kinds of duties. Also, when you think of land tax.
Okay, we're going to stop. Brief response.
Yes, what a brilliant question. I couldn't agree with you more. The Australian government makes a fetish of home ownership. It encourages it excessively, and it showers it with subsidies and tax breaks. And I think the a major cause of our problem is that we have, as you say, excessive exemptions from you know, capital gains tax, from land tax, and from the pension asset test. So basically it is subsidised. And I think that it's been established that if you over-subsidise something, you get too much of it, and you distort the actual economy that provides it. And I think that is really exemplified by the housing industry in this country, most definitely.
Just ask a quick final question. A lot of this is driven by what people want, isn't it? I mean, it's not so much what politicians say people want, but what people actually want to want homes. And if you look in Australia, homes have probably held up better than the stock exchange. I mean, when Steve Keen predicted a collapse of property values of 40%, I immediately offered to buy his apartment, 40% under the reserve price, and he wouldn't sell it to me. But if you have a look at it, if you had money in property here over the last 3 years, you'd be doing a lot better than you had money on the stock exchange. So perhaps the masses might be right.
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, up until the latest housing bubble, the jury was out on whether home ownership made economic sense. But I think now that the stock market has completely plummeted, you're probably safe if you put all your money into bricks and mortar. But once again, I think diversification is probably a good lesson to learn here. And you know, we've got such an unproductive asset, basically, an unproductive capital being invested into this one asset. I think it's not good for over indebted homeowners. It's not particularly good for nations either to have a form of capital that they actually can't take out of the country.
Many thanks, Nina. Take a seat. Look, it's been a lively night, actually, an interesting paper followed by a lively discussion period. As I said, there are copies of Renovation Nation outside. Fiona Ellen's one of our session members here. She comes along to our functions quite a bit. She's made an important contribution tonight, and I'm sure we'll have her back in the future. She's already had at least two tips for future research papers, I think, from the audience tonight. So
Well, let's see what the budget holds for education.
That's right. And
yes.
And meanwhile, Anne and I are just going back to this tent we've pitched in under the Sydney Harbour Bridge. And, it'll be cold, but gee, we'll feel good. So many thanks, Fiona, and it'd be a great paper to publish and put up on our pod on tomorrow. Thank you.
Right.
Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.